Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.
From KVPR, you're listening to Valley Edition. On this week's show, challenging stereotypes about Native Americans taught in the classroom. And later, it only happens once every 5 years, the City of Taft's celebration of black gold, Oil Dorado. But first, on Tuesday, Governor Gavin Newsom declared a drought emergency for all 58 counties in California. As KVPR's Mati Bolaños reports, one farmer in West Fresno County has been dealing with the impact of the drought for months now.
Joe Del Bosque has owned his farm west of Mendota for 36 years. He's grown cherries, tomatoes, and asparagus, but the crop closest to his heart is melons. His dad began to grow melons in the Mendota area in the 1950s.
Well, they've been in my blood for all my life. I feel a very intimate relationship with melons.
He now owns 2,000 acres of land on both sides of Interstate 5. Typically, Del Bosque and other farmers on the west side of Fresno County receive their water through the Central Valley Project. That water flows from Northern California to the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta and gets pumped through a network of canals. 3 decades ago, Del Bosque and other farmers on the west side began experiencing water cutbacks. They had to change how they watered crops. On a windy Tuesday morning, Del Bosque gives us a tour of his farm and his water infrastructure. At times, he has to hold on to his wide-brim hat to prevent it from flying away in a gust of wind. He hops out of his white Chevy SUV and walks toward a row of trees. He bends down to grab a black tube laying near the base of the trees.
This is a drip on our almonds.
He holds up a piece of his drip irrigation system that he installed nearly 15 years ago to save water. But this year, that's not enough. 2021 is the second driest year in California's history, according to a recent report from the California Department of Water Resources. Due to the drought, federal officials in May said growers would receive 0% of their water supply allocation from the Central Valley Project.
We had to go find water to buy from other farmers in Northern California that were willing to sell us some water. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been able to survive.
Del Bosque says water is now costing him 4 times more than normal. He usually pays $200 an acre foot for water from the Central Valley Project. But this year, he says, he paid other farmers nearly $800 an acre foot. And still, he says 1/3 of his 2,000 acres went unplanted this year. Our tour of the farm continues in Del Bosque's car. He drives us across I-5. He points to an empty field where melons are typically grown.
This is my field right here, the bare one here. That field was not planted this year.
He says he didn't plant nearly 300 acres of melons. And he cut out asparagus altogether. Ryan Jacobson, CEO of the Fresno County Farm Bureau, says this is a reality for many farmers across the county.
What happens in these droughts is that farmers are going to divert whatever water they do have available to their higher valuable, longer term investments.
Like nut trees and grapevines. That means certain crops may not grow in the Central Valley in the next 5 to 10 years. He says that should worry people.
We are at a time or a crossroads where it looks like we're going to see a significant reduction in the amount of food that we grow here in the valley.
Back on the farm, Joe Del Bosque is at his own crossroads. While rain is predicted for the Central Valley in the coming days, experts are predicting another dry winter. Del Bosque knows the decisions he makes will impact his family business, as well as 15 full-time employees and additional seasonal workers.
Maybe you can fallow land, but you can't fallow people.
For KVPR News, I'm Adi Bolaños.
This story is part of the Central Valley News Collaborative, which is supported by the Central Valley Community Foundation with technology and training support by Microsoft Corporation. This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Nearly 600,000 people visited the Big Fresno Fair earlier this month, many for the fried Oreos or the cinnamon buns or Smokey Robinson on the main stage. But for hundreds of students, the draw was to show off their agricultural business skills. As KVPR's Carrie Klein reports, they were so glad to be back after a year practically lost to COVID.
The first thing you notice in the livestock pavilion at the Big Fresno Fair is the sound. There's the animals, of course, cows and goats being steered to their enclosures, the hogs less than excited about being bathed, and the blow dryers fluffing up freshly shorn sheep. But behind all that is the thrum of an excited crowd.
First call, class 11, FFA market hogs, first call, class 11.
The hurried footsteps of polished boots and the cheers of proud parents. This is the fair's annual livestock show and auction. And among the more than 800 middle and high school competitors this year are Nicholas and Nathaniel Bonami.
My steer's name is Bear because he's big and he's big like a bear.
And my steer's name is Jack. I don't really know why I called him that. I just kind of like the name Jack.
The 14 and 16-year-old brothers go to Sanger High School. They raise their cattle in an enclosure in their backyard.
They're affectionate, basically. Like, they always come over to you.
Like, I've had ones that were just wild animals. Like, the one I have right now, I mean, we go on walks like people walk their dog.
The Bonami brothers have participated in Future Farmers of America, or FFA, since they were little kids. FFA and its sister program, 4-H, are practically full-time jobs. Members feed their animals before and after school and bathe and train them almost every day. But everything changed with the pandemic. With virtual school, Nathaniel and his brother had a lot more time to spend with Bear and Jack.
I call them COVID cows.
And they started taking them to class.
Our Wi-Fi reaches out there, so I just kind of prop myself against my cow because he won't get up. He'll just lay down, and I can, like, lay on top of him, lay next to him. So I'll just be in my class laying right with him on my iPad listening to my virtual teacher.
That may have been sweet, but last year's fair was utterly disappointing. Every October, it's the culmination of the months of work these students put into their animals. But unlike this year, most of the fair was drive-through only, and the livestock shows were scaled back.
It was a one-day fair, and then we're back to the week-long, so it feels good to be here, like, all day long.
Lori King, the fair's deputy manager, agrees.
This is what it's all about. You know, last year it was a whole host of things, but it definitely wasn't normal.
She says many fairs shut down altogether last year, but the Big Fresno Fair worked with the county to keep the livestock events going. They were shorter, but they kept the kids working toward a goal.
There is nothing that can teach you more responsibility than caring for an animal. So it's, you know, you take the life of that animal into your hands.
The week of the competition, groups of students trot their animals out in front of judges in the middle of the pavilion, and in the wings are the enclosures where the animals eat and sleep.
This is the male, and that's the female.
Giselle Galaviz leads me to her hogs, Chewy and Coco, two speckled canvases of black, pink, and gray lying snout to snout in the sawdust.
They're very attached to each other, so they lay, like, right next to each other.
Yeah, they're snuggling.
Yeah.
Galaviz is a sophomore at Central High School in Fresno, and it's her first year in FFA, so she had to learn how the animals would be judged. One category is market readiness, how healthy and sturdy they look, and the ratio of fat to muscle on their bones.
So they want the front and back views, as well as the side views going back and forth. And for, like, showmanship, they like to see the way you present yourself while walking the pig.
Most of these animals will be sold for meat or dairy at the final auction. The winners fetch the highest price. Galaviz knows all this, but she still wonders if it'll be hard to say goodbye.
I don't know. It might be. From past, I've heard people cry, so I'm a little scared. Yeah.
But these programs aren't just about the animals. Joseph Ortega is a senior at Layton High School, and his first year in FFA has been challenging. He couldn't afford a hog at first, but his chapter rallied and helped him pay for it. Then he was told he had to step up after missing a few meetings.
It was a little difficult, and I'm just glad that they gave me this chance to just show, because, like, yeah, it's my first time, and I felt good about it.
He says spending these last few months with his hog, Sarah Starr, helped him gain a sense of purpose and pride.
Look at where I'm at. I'm making it. Like, I'm doing what I have to do. I feel happy for myself. And just, like, to show my parents and my family that anything is possible and I could be something in this world.
His school did not participate in the fair in 2020, but he's so glad they did this year. For KVPR, I'm Carrie Klein.
After the fair ended, Carrie checked back in with these students. At the auction at the end of the fair, the Benami brothers both won awards for their cattle, Jack and Bear. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Our news director, Alice Daniel, has been spending time in Chowchilla in preparation for KVPR's upcoming podcast, The Other California, which tells the stories of small towns in the San Joaquin Valley and the people who live there. One of the many interesting people she's come to know is a horse trainer with more than 50 years of experience.
If there's one thing I've learned from Leland Decker, it's this. People who love to be around horses, they really love to be around horses. There's no gray area.
My work is horses. My spare time is horses. My hobby is horses.
His vacation is horses.
I don't have a boat. I don't have a camper. I don't play golf. I don't play tennis. I don't go fishing. I don't go hunting.
The horse track on his property, he built it. He even welded the pipe fencing around it. He trains riders to exercise the horses.
All right, they're going to go around again, then they're going to pull up, and then they're going to the gates.
For decades, he galloped the horses himself. But at 72, his well-worn cowboy boots stand firmly on the ground.
About the time you get the experience and your brain's working really good, the body's wearing out. That's why I have these guys that are younger, but I watch what's getting done and I tell them what I want done and I make sure it's done the way I want it.
And that's from day one when young horses first get broken in at Green Valley Training Center.
This horse just got here. We just started him.
Leland points to a 2-year-old thoroughbred walking in circles inside a round pen.
He's learning to carry his saddle. He's learning to give to the bit so you can guide him.
From there, the horse will progress to learning the fundamentals, stopping and going, all the way to galloping and racing. It can take from 3 to 5 months.
People say, well, how long does it take to train a horse? How long does it take to educate a person? It depends on the individual, the skill and knowledge of the teacher, and what you consider educated. Do you want an 8th grade education or you want a PhD?
Leland's motto is, you have to be able to read the horse. Nothing is more important. It's what he tells the young trainers who work for him, like 24-year-old Fallon O'Neill.
You need a lead rope, Fallon.
Yes, sorry.
Oh, Jeff, you got your one.
Okay. She grew up on a farm and started riding horses just a couple years after she learned to walk. At one point, she says, she really wanted to be a jockey.
I was just obsessed with it. I'm like, oh my gosh, I can do that. And then with there being so few women in the industry, I was like, yes, this is what I want to do.
But now she just likes working with the young horses. She calls them the babies, and learning from Leland. Still, when she's on the track with another trainer, Narciso Sanchez, they act like they're jockeys.
The closest I get is out there on the track when Narciso pretends to be Seabiscuit and I'm Secretariat.
Seabiscuit and Secretariat, two champion racehorses of different eras. Years ago, Leland says, one of the horses he trained later made it to the Kentucky Derby. But it's really hard to predict the success of a horse. People who buy racehorses may see it as a business.
Okay, they call it an investment and they call it business, but you're gambling. You're gambling. When you purchase a horse, you're making your best guesstimate that these horses would be successful. Maybe 10% of them are.
The height of horse racing, Leland says, was in the 1940s and 50s. It was more popular than baseball.
The race is the Westerner, the 18th running of Hollywood's version of the Derby, and the horse to watch is Round Table, favored at 3-20.
If you look at the old newscast when they built and opened Hollywood Park, the movie stars were there. The stands were packed. You know, I mean, well, that's gone now. They tore it down. Hollywood Park no longer exists.
But Leland, who is raking the track, still has plenty of thoroughbreds to train. And he still rides for fun. He even competes in roping events at the Chowchilla Stampede. But he's had a number of injuries. Once, a horse kicked him from the side.
About 10 years ago, I had a horse cow kick me, which means they reach up and kick like this instead of directly behind. Took out both knees.
His tolerance for pain seems to rival his love of horses. Even though he has horses of his own, he still goes to horse auctions. He can't be trusted, he says.
Liable to come home with one I don't need.
And what does your wife say?
At this point of her life, we've been married for over 50 years. At this point, she just kind of shakes her head and goes, oh, God.
Just the other week, he says, he saw this incredible bay mare and... well, let's just leave it at that. For KVPR News, I'm Alice Daniel.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. While working as an elementary school teacher in the Central Valley, Marie Casau was disturbed by how her fellow educators taught Indigenous history to their students. So after earning a master's degree in education from Fresno State, she created a curriculum of resources for teachers looking to challenge stereotypes about Native Americans in their classrooms. I spoke with Casau about the project.
My understanding is that this work was inspired by your experiences as an elementary school teacher. Can you share a little bit about that?
So I just kind of saw that there was still just a lot of stereotypes and just a lot of issues amongst, at least in the elementary school sector. I can't speak for other sectors, but working with high school students, as Native students as well, they also expressed to me that their teachers and other students would say inappropriate things to them as well. And so I just kind of felt like I want to do something about it, but I can't really do it in the capacity of, you know, teaching full time, let's say. So that got me thinking, like, you know, maybe I should go back and get a master's degree.
You know, I'm curious to get your thoughts on how Indigenous culture is handled traditionally in the classroom and in textbooks and in curriculum.
Yeah, I mean, teaching in the state of California, at least, I can't necessarily speak for other states, but yes, there is a lack of content. A lot of the content is, you know, prior to the 1800s, some early 1900s things, but not really. They don't really go into modern day contexts. And they did try to kind of amend this with an addition they had to the historical standards when they were revamping them. Instead of releasing all new standards, they kind of released something instead to be like, here, look at this, here's some gaps you might want to address. And that does mention the American Indian movement and other more modern movements within the last 100 years. But what teacher is going to go out of their way to look for this extra piece and then actually implement it? So I feel like we're going in a right direction, but there's still just a lot of unaddressed issues. Like today, I actually saw a video of a teacher down in Southern California just doing the craziest thing. She decided in order to teach a math concept, she was going to put on a paper headband and just start singing in front of her class, doing whoops and war chant, you know, all the stereotypical stuff, getting on tables and then talking about these mystical stones. And this just happened.
Oh, my word.
Yeah. And these kinds of things happen all the time. So clearly, you know, it's something that's not being understood or not addressed, that teachers themselves are the ones doing this. They're the ones dressing up as cowboys and Indians. They're the ones, even here in the Valley, we have Pioneer Days when, and talking about Oklahoma land runs. I'm like, we're in California. why do we have teepees set up here? Like, there's a tribe right here up the hill. So there's just, I think, a lot of gaps, and the teachers aren't being taught when they grow through the education system. So then they perpetuate these stereotypes. They're not being taught in their teaching programs how to address, you know, Native students. So I think it's just a lot of things need to change, essentially.
What you describe in schools just reminds me of what we see throughout our society, what we see certainly in our media with Native stories, you know, where so many rely on either stereotypical images of Indigenous people or position them as figures that only existed in the past.
Exactly. And museums, I think, are trying, some museums are doing well and trying to change, but, you know, you take a trip to a museum and what do you see? Everything about the Native histories of the area, let's say, are all written in past tense. They used to do this. They lived here. They did that. And a lot of things are still kind of highlighted in a primitive manner. And then we have movies, spaghetti westerns, and different things that kind of put it in this cultural identity when, you know, we have people who are essentially doing red face in a lot of old Hollywood films, and they perpetuated a lot of these Hollywood Indian essential stereotypes that are still proliferate today, especially in our mascots all over. Lots of schools have mascots, even here in the Valley. So yeah, it's just a big issue. And it's really hard to educate adults. So at least if we can get to students and teach them, you know, Natives are still around, you know, their communities everywhere, especially displaced, like urban Natives, Natives, of course, who got assimilated. So they are no longer tied to their communities anymore through no fault of their own, through the foster care system. You know, you have the boarding school. That's been a big issue that's come to light from Canada and here in the US, still finding bodies of students who attended boarding schools. There's all these things going on. And it's one of those things where it's such a big undertaking. And there's people that want to learn and they're open to learning, but then there's a lot of people that are just like, it's in the past, get over it. And it's like, no, it's still happening.
Right. Well, let's talk about some of the work that you're involved with to reverse these ideas that are perpetuating our education system. Tell me about this curriculum that you're working on developing. As you went about curating material to be used in the classroom, what were you looking for?
You know, I started kind of curating links and different things you could do to figure out, well, whose territory do you live on? Who, you know, is the tribe federally recognized, state recognized? You know, those are the first steps to trying to figure out, well, where are you? Why isn't there a tribal group in your area? Maybe they got displaced, or maybe a mission system basically, you know, took them out of that area, especially in California. For some reason, we love doing the missions in fourth grade. And we love kind of glorifying the mission system. And I feel like we also have to acknowledge the good with the bad, you know, depending on what side you're on. Let's say that, you know, we ripped children from their homes and essentially told them, or, you know, whole communities and forced them into kind of slavery, basically, to build these missions. And so we can't, you know, we have to acknowledge both sides of that. So that's talking about the past. But then also in California, you know, we had the American Indian movement, like we had an occupation at Alcatraz, like we had a lot of things. It was illegal to practice any sort of religious spirituality type things for Indigenous people up until the 70s. And people don't realize that. Like, there are a lot of laws that went on for a lot longer than other cultural, you know, other groups. And so I feel like those are the kinds of things that need to be talked on and need to be stressed.
So how has this work informed your thoughts about what needs to change in order to improve the educational outcomes for Native students?
I think, especially in the U.S., with teacher preparation programs, there should be some sort of class just dedicated to talking about Native history, because no matter where you are, you know, in North America or just anywhere in the world, there was an Indigenous group that inhabited it. And because, like I said, there's a lot of displaced and urban Natives that may not know too much about their past because of, you know, all this historical trauma and displacement and assimilation that went on. So I feel like teacher prep programs are really need to be revamped because those are the teachers coming out with the credentials and then going into these schools. And then also, if you look at statistics, pretty much Native students across the board, you know, compared to other ethnic groups, they have some of the highest dropout rates, highest suicide rates, highest rates of depression. They have like all these staggering rates. But because it's such a small population, they're usually seen as statistically insignificant. So, and I've interacted personally with teachers that have told me to my face when I was talking on behalf of high school students that essentially, oh, they'll be fine. They'll just go, you know, they're going to be helped by their casino money. They're just going to get money and they'll just live on the res and it's okay. Like, and I've had other teachers just blatantly tell me like, I need to help the other students because they think every Native gets a free, you know, free ride to whatever, like that they just get all these handouts. So they feel like, well, I got to help the other students because they don't have that, you know, saving, you know, hand. And it's just kind of like, it's such a weird mentality, but I've heard it from multiple teachers throughout my career. Or like, I've heard it, you know, just offhand, people talk about how they got their ancestry test and now they're Native. And the first thing you hear from everyone in the room is like, ooh, can I start getting a check now? And just like,
wow.
Yeah. And it's just something that you think, oh, that can't be happening, but it does happen, you know, and how can you humanize Natives when they're still seen as mascots or Halloween costumes or this cute little Thanksgiving project?
Well, I've been talking with Marie Casau, Program Officer with the American Indian Science and Engineering Society. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Valley Edition. We'll be back with more stories after the break.
Hi, I'm KVPR science reporter Carrie Klein, asking you to join me and Science Friday's Ira Flato for a super fun live stream trivia night this Saturday at 5 p.m. It's part sciencey facts, part dance party, and part local news romp. And it's for anyone looking to bring together teams or bravely play solo to win ultimate bragging rights plus some great prizes. Proceeds benefit KVPR. Tickets are $30 and available now at kvpr.org.
Hey y'all, Sam Sanders here, host of It's Been a Minute. Each week, we bring you a wrap of the week's news and introduce you to people driving the culture. We also share joyful moments from listeners' lives. Because after the last year, we could all use some good news. At its best, public radio does all these things. It informs, entertains, and inspires connection. But we can't do this without listener support. Make your donation today at kvpr.org.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Since 1989, October has been designated as Domestic Violence Awareness Month. But misperceptions about domestic violence continue to permeate our culture. To learn more, I spoke with Tracy Salisbury, Assistant Professor of Interdisciplinary and Ethnic Studies at California State University, Bakersfield.
So I feel like there's a gap between what the, let's say, quote-unquote, average person thinks domestic violence is or what it looks like compared to what it actually is. And because of that disconnect, it can make it difficult for those who are experiencing intimate partner violence to recognize it for what it is. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts about that.
I think that's an excellent way to start. I do think that's very true. I think that instead of saying domestic violence was kind of a horror movie word, let's say domestic abuse. So people understand that this runs the gamut of abusive language, not allowing an adult to make decisions in what should be an equal relationship. Stalking is domestic abuse. Harassment is domestic abuse. I think when we hear people say domestic violence, they're actually looking for physical violence all the time. This is something domestic abuse or domestic violence is something that frightens, intimidates, meant to manipulate, to control. It is a very broad idea that it can happen to anyone. It's not just women. Men are abused. Children are abused. We need to be more honest about how prevalent this is in our society in order to deal with it.
In talking about domestic abuse that is not physical in nature, can you talk about some of the challenges in accessing help or seeking resources to get out of those situations? How much more difficult is it when it is not necessarily physical abuse?
Well, I'll use a term like gaslighting, is letting someone believe something is not what it is. As human beings, we all want to be loved. We all want to be touched. And we have a way of justifying something that we know is abusive, that we would not tolerate from a stranger, but we tolerate it from a loved one. And that is, you know, I will never hurt you again. I will never speak to you in that fashion again. I will consult with you, and then this doesn't happen. And so the person who is being abused takes it upon the burden upon themselves to say, well, I could do better, or I won't raise my voice, or I won't argue with that person. And then what you end up is in a situation where you are being controlled. And then when you wake up to that, you either don't like the control, or the control is something too hard to live with, that you can't get out of it. And, you know, I would say, even though physical abuse is still a problem, this kind of mental abuse, this kind of social control, it's hard to prove. It's hard to give evidence of. You know, most abusers are very well versed into what situations they can get away with it in. When we get home, you know, or you can use somebody on the way somewhere to get them to behave. And so when you have people publicly behave a way that says, oh, there's nothing wrong, but at home privately, there's something very wrong, it creates a very difficult situation to get out of it.
You know, it seems to me that the pandemic probably exacerbated that for many people, creating conditions that made it even more difficult to leave an abusive situation.
Most certainly, because of course, resources are stretched to the max during the pandemic. There are, you know, we're requiring on law enforcement and mental health agencies are now dealing with a multitude of issues, and domestic violence cases are like sexual assault cases. They get low on the totem pole because it's oftentimes a he said, she said, or she said, she said situation. These are very difficult cases to prosecute because people change their minds. People, adults are embarrassed. So this, it becomes a deeper challenge. I'm highly concerned about what's occurred during the pandemic on underreporting right now. People probably not telling, people interacting in very small spaces. We're also in a very volatile state as a country on multitude issues. And when people are together, this is the breeding ground for this kind of domestic abuse.
Earlier, you mentioned that this is not gender specific, that this is not, that women are not the only victims of domestic abuse or domestic violence. Can you speak more about how this kind of abuse plays out in different populations?
Well, we have to bring intersectionality into this. You know, people want these kind of cases to be, oh, it's because you're in poverty, or this is minority populations. These are people who are not married. And that could be nothing further than the truth. Domestic violence affects people of all socioeconomic backgrounds and all education levels. The greatest concern is how domestic violence is manifesting itself in high school teenagers and college students, that these are very early relationships to be exposed to this kind of behavior, which leads to trends, if you don't get help, that may continue into what we call mature adulthood. These are things that if you are violent towards your partner, if you're violent towards your spouse, the likelihood is you're going to be violent towards your children. We are in a baby boomer generation where highly stressed adults are looking after elderly parents. And, you know, can you imagine on both sides being in a situation where you're in a stressful relationship with an elderly parent and a stressful relationship with an abusive partner. I mean, I don't know what the exit, you know, the off-ramp is to that. LGBT communities have a large domestic violence problem. I mean, when you're talking statistics, you're talking about 1 in 4 women, 1 in 7 men will experience some kind of physical violence in their lifetime. That is an extremely high number.
So certainly there is a conversation around domestic violence today that wasn't there when I was growing up. We're talking about it more. We're acknowledging it as part of our society in a way that we were not, let's say, 10, 20 years ago. Do you see that as a sign that things are moving in the right direction or not?
I think talking and making things public is always moving in the right direction. My concern is what is the public reaction to abuse? Have we become so indoctrinated and comfortable with abuse that we don't view it as intolerable, or that we don't view it as something that should be punishable? I mean, if you look at R. Kelly's case, was more than sexual violence. He was terrorizing these women in his thing, and this went on for nearly 25 years. If you look at, there was a recent assault on a public subway train where no one intervened. They actually raised up their cameras and recorded it. We record violence against one another. We're getting into a point that talking may not be enough. Is that, do we have enough agencies and resources and spaces to tackle this issue? If we look at a national case like Gabby Petito's, where, in my opinion, there was a domestic violence issue here that needed to be handled immediately and ended this trip. But police and family and friends allowed this trip to go on, and a young lady ends up dead. It's looking like maybe possibly this young man is dead as well. This was not handled in a way that was best for the individuals involved. It was still handled with kid gloves. So I think we have a crisis. I think we need to view it as a crisis. We need further legislation. We need more resources. We need better trained law enforcement to deal with these issues.
So in light of the statistics you shared, undoubtedly, somebody who's listening to this conversation is living with intimate partner violence. What message do you have for them?
I would say, number one, it's not your fault. You may feel alone, but you are not alone. That you need to do the best you can to try to get out of the situation. I don't say that lightly, because this is not an easy thing to do. That the bottom line is that you need to make a plan to see if you can get out of this situation. Tell someone. Tell someone that you think will believe you. Try to tell someone that you think will help you. The key to being stuck in these relationships is the victim's belief that they can't find help, that no one can help them. Because when hope is lost, then you just resign yourself to your situation. So I think for anyone in this difficult, difficult situation, you must try to find someone to believe you and to help you.
I've been talking with Dr. Tracy Salisbury, Assistant Professor of Interdisciplinary Studies and Ethnic Studies at CSU Bakersfield. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, Kathleen, it's my pleasure. Anytime.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Margarita Engel, the celebrated author and poet who calls the Central Valley home, published 2 new books this year. The first, Your Heart, My Sky, is a young adult novel written in verse. The second is a children's picture book titled A Song of Frutas. I spoke with her about how both books were inspired by her Cuban-American heritage.
Let's talk about the young adult novel called Your Heart, My Sky. So it tells this beautiful story of 2 young people falling in love amidst an economic crisis that gripped Cuba in the 1990s. For context, tell us about that time in Cuban history.
Thank you, first of all, for seeing it as a love story. It was intended that way. People do fall in love no matter how difficult the times. The historical context is really abrupt. Very suddenly in 1991, due to the collapse of the Soviet Union, as well as internal inefficiencies in Cuba's own lack of planning in their agriculture and so forth, food basically disappeared. People were starving. It was drastic. And I think the pandemic has shown us that that can happen anywhere in the world at any time, that something can suddenly disappear. I mean, for us, it was toilet paper last year, but what if it had been food? So the context for me personally is that I had visited my relatives in Cuba as a child before the travel restrictions were imposed when diplomatic relations broke off during the early 1960s. And I hadn't been back to Cuba in 31 years. Then in 1991, just as this economic disaster hit, Cuba hosted the Pan American Games, and they put all their money into bringing tourism to the country, trying to establish a new economy. I was able to go back in the summer of 1991 for the first time in 31 years, and I was able to visit relatives. And I was horrified by the hunger. And I felt so troubled by, because of my US passport, being able to stay in a hotel and eat a good meal, whereas they had nothing. They would open their refrigerators and say, "We would offer you something, but we have nothing." And all there would be in their refrigerator was water. And every home in the country was like that. So I had written about it as it was happening, and I found very little interest in the United States among American readers at that time. And so I wanted to write about it. I was writing for adults at that time in the 90s. Then in the 2000s, I had switched to writing for children because I feel like children and young adults are much more open-minded readers.
That makes sense.
I have a lot more fun writing for children and young adults because the publishing industry is also more open-minded. I'm able to write everything in verse, and I'm happy when I write poetry. Whereas for adults, you're expected to write a lot of prose.
Right, right.
If you're gonna write a full-length novel, it's usually in prose. It would be very unusual to have a verse novel. So as long as I'm writing in poetry with this musical language, I feel like I can counteract the depressing aspect of this complex historical situation and really distill it down to its emotional essence. And I wanted to write about the emotions of a young couple falling in love despite near starvation.
Can you tell me more about these two protagonists at the center of this story and how they were drawn together in part through their individual acts of rebellion?
Yes, young people at that time were expected to do volunteer work on their vacations in the fields. And at that time, it was primarily sugarcane. So it was extremely difficult manual labor. They would live in barracks, and it was very much like training for being in the army a few years later. And both of these young people in the story had simply not shown up and refused to do their mandatory volunteer farm labor. It was called volunteer work, but it was mandatory. If you didn't do it, your whole family was punished in both overt and subtle ways. You were not going to get into a good university. You were not going to have any advantages in your education and so forth. Your family was going to be viewed with suspicion by the neighborhood committees that spied on each other. This is a very difficult situation to imagine, perhaps, for American young readers, but I think that there's been so much dystopia in the US during the last few years that it's perhaps less difficult to imagine than it would have been at the time when it was happening in the 90s.
Well, let's switch gears and talk about your other new book, A Song of Frutas, which is targeted at a much younger audience. And it is also a love story, but this one between a young girl visiting her grandfather in Cuba. Tell us a little bit more about the book.
Now, this book is also about food, but it's the exact opposite. In this story, the little girl who's going from the U.S. to Cuba to visit her grandfather, and her grandfather is un pregonero. These are the singing vendors. I loved them when I was a child in Cuba visiting in the 1950s and early 60s. I loved that everybody who was selling something sang about it. They would push a cart or have a mule drawn or horse drawn or oxen drawn cart come down the street and sing, you know, to get you to buy whatever they were selling. And so in this case, I wrote about a fruit vendor singing to attract customers, and the little girl is singing with him. It's a fun way for a child to learn the names of these fruits in English and Spanish. It's written in kind of a bilingual format, but it's a happy story, except that at the end, the little girl does wish that her grandfather could visit her too, because the travel, it is mostly in one direction. Relatives being able to go back to Cuba now, but not so easy for people to come from Cuba to the U.S. And so she writes letters, and the letters are a hug made of words. So there are several different aspects, but basically this one is a story of joy in the relationship between grandparents and grandchildren, and the love of music and singing that's so much part of Cuban culture.
Well, before I let you go, it would be wonderful if you would read a passage from the book.
Okay, this is just the very beginning. When we visit Abuelo, I help him sell frutas. We sing the names of each fruit as we walk. Our footsteps like drum beats and hands like maracas, shaking bright food shapes while we chant with the rhythm. Mango, limón, coco, melón, naranja, toronja, plátano, piña. Our voices are bridges that reach up to windows, inviting strangers to look out and become friends. Smiling people perch on balconies, listening to our cheerful music.
Well, I've been talking with Margarita Engel, author and poet. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us and talk about your two new books.
Thank you.
And finally, the town of Taft just marked another oil dorado. The little city above an ocean of black gold goes all out, celebrating the resource that built it. Among the festivities were the Maids of Petroleum pageant and a facial hair contest called Whiskerino. Our colleague Matt Gillum with KCRW went to the Fossil Fuel Festival and has this audio postcard.
Day or night, the sheriff of Oil Dorado is keeping an eye out for people to lock up. It's not jail.
Well, it's not. It's called the Juzgado. We call it the Juzgado, yeah.
Over more than 30 years, Brian Selman has risen from a deputy in the sheriff's posse to the main guy. Sporting a waistcoat, black cowboy hat, and a pair of revolvers, he says his primary job is making people smile.
We all ham it up and have a good time with it, and that's what it's all designed to do.
Another duty? Beard enforcement.
If you don't have a beard, then you have to get a smoothness badge, or we can arrest you, and we take you around town, just hoot it up, and it's all just for fun.
That's right, gents. Could be headed for the Juzgado if you didn't purchase a smooth puss badge. For those that do get nabbed, it's not that bad. There's talk of chilly adult beverages for the scruffless. Because it takes over the entire town, Taft celebrates Oil Dorado only once every 5 years. But like so many events, the petrol party was called off in 2020. Shannon Miller, the first female president of the Oil Dorado Committee, is appreciating its return.
You know, it's 10 days long and there's 65 events in those 10 days. And I've been able to, you know, have a sigh of relief to see that it's happening and everybody is receptive to it and people have shown up.
Over the course of the festival, she expects some 30,000 people to participate. Among them is Les Clark. The lifelong oilman is pushing 80 and got his start in the local oil fields.
There's a lot of hard-working people out here, and I think that this gives them a time to celebrate and say, hey, we're still here.
As in, these blue-collar oil jobs continue to be the backbone of Taft. Those are on display in one of Oil Dorado's biggest events, the Oil Field Skills Competition. There's a category for welding, crane operation, and one called roustabout. That's what Alex Hernandez is getting ready for. The 23-year-old was head roustabout at his oil company.
I had originally just joined for the welding competition, but I was talking to the president of the company, and he asked me to do the roustabout one. I'm more than happy to do it.
In the oil trade, roustabouts are the grunts who do a lot of the hardest physical labor before they climb the industry ladder. For this category, the competitors have to assemble a yard-long piece of pipe using a bunch of tools, including an orange wrench the length of your arm.
All right, here we go. Ready? Go!
Hernandez grabs the wrench and some pipe and sets to work. His focus is intense. At one point, he's pressing so hard on the wrench, his feet lift off the ground. There's plenty of hammering, too. With a couple final swings, Hernandez comes out of his trance.
Done.
For not originally signing up for the roustabout contest, Hernandez didn't do too bad.
It went just like it should. I think it's just the nervous that kind of got to me, me being nervous, but I think I did pretty good.
Better than good, he won and is now an Oil Dorado champion. For the 9,000 or so people who call the town of Taft home, all the hoopla is a way to show their pride. While Oil Dorado celebrates the community's petroleum past, black gold remains very much a part of the town's present. For NPR News, I'm Matt Gillum in Taft, California.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Mathi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.